So it's weird to be mic'd. So thank you very much for this chance to present. I really liked the talks this morning, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the week. I am going to talk about work. So the title of my talk is The Fundamental Theorem of Deeper Algebra. And I think most of the talk I want to tell you, I'm trying to get this term picked up. This is mostly me trying to convince you to use the word deeper algebra. And everything I say is joined in progress with David Reuter. We have promised ourselves, So for about 5 years, we've been saying the paper's going to be out this year, but usually we stop saying that by June. And I'm still saying it. And I think this might be the year. So here's my plan for the talk. I'm going to tell you, this is a talk about Galois theory. This is a really, really wide audience of like lots and lots of different knowledge and expertise. I'm going to kind of assume that you at some point in your life saw a first course in Galois theory, I'm going to assume you probably have at least once seen what a Galois extension is. But if you haven't, that's great. And my goal is to be, please interrupt with questions or ask me later. Like, I love this story. And if you're like really, really bored, interrupt too and tell me. Like, as I said, one of my goals is to sort of explain what I want to call, maybe I'm the unique person. I want to get more like people talking about deeper algebra. So first I have to tell you what higher algebra is to set up a comparison. And then I'll tell you what I want to call deeper algebra. And then I'll give some example, like I'll sort of tell you what we understand about sort of, most of it's about the fact that the language I'm going to explain sort of, I think, cleans up a lot of quite classical story about Galois theory. And if I have time, I'll tell you a physics application at the end that I won't have to, but I'm sure I won't be able to explain how it works. And I only have like 12 slides, so I can take a while and you can ask questions and I can use the board. I don't usually use slides, so. So higher algebra. So higher algebra, we've seen, like Amelia already talked about some of this this morning. I would say that basically the defining feature of the notion of set, what makes a set, is that questions in Bourbaki and set theory, in undergraduate mathematics, we always present questions as if they have precise yes-no answers. Like you pick up two things and ask, is this the same as that? And it's either yes or no. And we set up this sort of, we teach undergraduates, maybe some of you are undergraduates, I don't know, or we teach undergraduates that the definition of a set is that it's a bag of elements and sets are determined by their elements, and you can even ask, like, are these two sets equal? And this is all a perfectly good way to set up foundations for some things, but it doesn't really do a good job of capturing actual ways that mathematicians actually want to work. And this was sort of a theme in this morning's talk. So when you actually want to work with mathematical objects, you would like to say things, you know, you'd like to say, for instance, you know, maybe you'd like to say that there are, that the cyclic group of order 3, you'd like to say that word, the cyclic group of order 3. And now stop and think a moment, like the cyclic group of order 3 is a terrible phrase in classical, the way we teach undergraduate mathematics, because there isn't, like, maybe you meant specifically the quotient of Z by the roots, by the multiples of 3. And then you could say, well, that's what I mean by the cyclic group of order 3. I mean the cyclic group of order 3 equipped with a generator. And then you scratch your head and ask yourself, like, well, are the third roots of unity a cyclic group of order? They are a cyclic group of order 3, but they're not the cyclic group of order 3. And you want to say, these two things are the same. Are they equal? Not in the sense of my undergraduate textbook. But that was because nothing's equal in the sense of my undergraduate textbook. They are the same, but there's not one way that they're the same. They're the same in some set way. Another example that I also like, sometimes even there's other cases where you have where two things are the same in only one way. Somewhere in your undergraduate analysis course, you prove that there's only one field of real numbers. What did you really prove? The fields of there's a field, which is the field of Dedekind cuts in the rational numbers. There's a field which is the field of Cauchy completions of the rational numbers. These are not equal. They have different elements. They're isomorphic in only one way, so they might as well be equal. But they're not equal. not in the sort of undergraduate, in the, I don't know, the Bourbaki sense of equal. So obviously sets are the wrong thing to work with. So let's move higher. So I think everybody in this room is already saying, like, Theo, you're being way too old-fashioned. Of course, we know what categories are. We know what isomorphism is. This is a useful framework. And I agree, it is a useful, that's the whole point of this slide. It is a useful framework. So a groupoid is a thing, it's a bag of things where instead of having a binary question of two things are equal, you have a set worth of ways two things are equal. And of course, still you should have, like, equality has the things that equality has. It has a transitive and symmetric relationship. But that's a silly place to stop. Like, why would there be a set of ways for things to be equal? There could be a groupoid of ways for things to be equal. And then you go and invent two groupoids, and you write like a page of axioms for what a two groupoid is. And then you say, okay, but that's a silly place to stop. Like, there could be a two groupoid of ways for things to be equal. And then you realize that three rounds to infinity. So the definition of an infinity groupoid is an infinity groupoid is a bag of things for which if you take two things in your bag and ask what are the ways that they're equal, the answer is an infinity groupoid. And that's the definition of infinity groupoid. So anyway, this is other words for infinity groupoid are like anima or homotopy type. I think I kind of different days, like I think I wrote this slide with anima and then halfway through the slide changed it. Like different days I feel different ways about the names. My favorite name, but I didn't put on the slide, anime is just a word for soul. And I would love if people would just call these souls, because then you can still use the letter S instead of. And I'm a homotopy theorist. Every second thing is called S. The sphere is called S. Suspension is called S. The category of sets is called S. Category of souls is called S. Like, integration is called. I just write S everywhere. That's just like S. Okay, whatever. So an infinity groupoid. That's a good place to do mathematics. Is like to work with infinity groupoids as your starting objects. And yes, you can develop infinity groupoid theory out of set theory, and that's been mostly done. It's under development, but it's sort of a good place to develop it. But at the end of the day, your years of interface might be infinity groupoids, the same way that you can develop set theory out of logic, but at the end of the day, your years of interface was set theory. And I put this up just to point out, like, well, this is called higher mathematics, and that's a good name. I mean, it sort of captures the intuition. The way I think most people here will know that you can think, a good way to think of an infinity groupoid is you think of the elements as kind of zero-dimensional things that live inside your groupoid, and you think of the ways that elements are equal, the equalities between elements as paths. So those are one-dimensional things. And I told you the bag of ways two things can be equal, it should be another infinity groupoid. So there's paths between paths. Those look like two-dimensional paths. So an infinity groupoid very naturally is thought of as some higher dimensional object. And it's a good way to picture what these are, is as higher things. Hello, computer. Oh. Okay. And then you might say that by definition, higher algebra is the algebra you get by just doing all of the algebra that you know, but doing it with infinity groupoids instead of sets. And that's probably all I'm going to say about higher algebra. Well, okay, so I have some sort of comments, mostly for the experts, which is that if you know what a spectrum is, if you don't know what a spectrum is, like, turn your brain off, like turn your ears off for like 10 seconds. If you know what a spectrum is, then I think the good definition, like higher algebra, I'm going to only do commutative algebra. Higher commutative algebra is the subject, is the study of the infinity ring spectra. It's a very, very valuable and active area of research, and it's not what my talk is about. I just wanted to talk about it to sort of tell you what my talk's actually about. So this is basically the subject of multiplicative cohomology theories. And ordinary algebra, lower algebra, like lives inside of higher algebra as the sort of those infinity groupoids that happen to be sets. We saw this morning's talk that it might happen that your bag of ways for two things to be equal is either empty or, like, you might decide that empty is the same as no, and the unique set with one element is the same as yes, and at which point you've decided that sets are examples of infinity group points. Okay, so my talk's not about higher algebra. My talk's going to be about deeper algebra. And I wanted to set up higher algebra so that I can tell you this other direction that you can
generalize. We've got a question from the audience.
Yes.
So is higher algebra like trying to internalize algebra to like infinity group points, or is it?
I would say, I mean, this is of course not this is not a mathematical definition, this is a sociological definition. Mm-hmm. So the sociological definition is that higher algebra, and maybe I should have put a capital A, I'm not defining a higher algebra, I'm defining the subject of higher algebra. Mm-hmm. And I would say that higher algebra with capital letters is what you get by trying to do all of algebra, or maybe all of commutative algebra, but where you never say the word set, you always say the word infinity groupoid or homotopy type or whatever equivalent. Those, as I said, there's a lot of words that are synonyms of each other. I don't care which word you use. You can use your own, and in different days you might identify differently. But higher algebra is we have 100 years of developing commutative algebra, more than 100 years, 150 or something like that. Like, you know, you look at people like Noether or Hilbert, they were doing really a sophisticated commutative algebra, studying ring theory. And higher algebra is about, to my mind, is sort of mostly about doing that, but where you also recognize that elements of a ring might have interesting isomorphisms between them. Like you might want to say, oh, okay, 50 years ago you recognized that the K theory of a space had a ring structure to it. And now you really want to say, what was K theory of a space? K theory is something about like isomorphism classes of stable bundles. Well, I shouldn't have said isomorphism class. I should really work with stable bundles and their isomorphisms. And I could still say, like, that has a ring. This will almost be an example. Like, wait two slides, and this will be an example. There is a ring structure on vector bundles. We could think of that as a ring, legit. Like, think of it as a ring. And then you'd say, oh, the K theory of a space is better than just the these abelian groups called the K theory of that space. There's actually a sort of a higher object that has all the vector bundles and their isomorphisms packaged together. And now you could still say, this is an example of a commutative ring. I still want to use all these things I know about commutative ring theory. Like I want to study ring theory questions sensitive to that higher structure. That's what I think higher algebra is about.
And I guess it'd be like a suitable, like higher notion of commutativity?
Yeah, I mean, is there a power over here? There's not, okay. I'm trying to avoid, the word E infinity is the word that the experts know means kind of the fully coherent notion of commutative. But there's really, what does commutative mean? Commutative means that if you take any, so what is a ring? A ring is a thing for which if you take the undergraduate definition of a ring was that if you took two elements, you could multiply them together. And then you had a bunch of weird axioms that if you took three elements and multiplied them with different parentheses, it didn't matter. And I don't know what a non-abelian ring is. I only know about commutative rings. So that's another axiom of the form. If you take two elements, then some equations hold. This is a minimal model. It's a minimal packaging of the definition of commutative ring. But it's not what a commutative ring really is. What a commutative ring really is it's a thing where if you have any finite set of elements, you can multiply them. And it doesn't matter how you put parentheses or ordering on that finite set. And then you prove a theorem that says that's, like, if I want to ask you to give me the data type that has a multiplication for every finite set, that's a boatload of data type, and it can be compressed. And so often when we teach ring theory, we do this funny thing. We, instead of teaching what a ring really is, we teach the compression of a ring. And it's like, which makes sense if I'm trying to hand you, like, I don't really want to hand you a full image file. I want to hand you a nice compressed thing. But then you still want to look at the picture, right? So an E-infinity ring is just by definition that. It's a thing called a spectrum. I haven't told you what a spectrum is. A spectrum is what a homotopy theorist, the word spectrum is an unfortunate word because it has nothing to do with what are actual spectra of light. But spectrum is, you can just read, if you say that you see the word spectrum, you could just think that that's what a homotopy theorist says when they want to say abelian group. And then an E-infinity ring is this sort of homotopical version of abelian group together with, for every finite set, a way to multiply, of elements in that abelian group, a way to multiply them. And that's all it is.
So, thank you.
And the word infinity is there because, okay, if you hand me my backpack, I have a plug, then I maybe this won't keep turning off. The word infinity and E-infinity, E just means, I don't know why E is there. I think E is the first letter of commutative. And is it that where it's from? I don't actually, So Lang's algebra uses the letter E for like the integers for some reason having to do with the word commutative or integral or entire or something like that. And I thought that's where it came from, but I could be wrong. Yeah, I don't know why the letter E is used. E infinity is not the like infinity version of something called E, it's just something else. And the infinity there is because one of the ways, like there's a list of things that goes from something like E0 up to E infinity, where E1 is like associative. And then if you scratch your head and ask yourself, what is associative multiplication? That's about things on a line. And the essential, sort of the most basic thing on the, and so it's like a one-dimensional. And you might know the fact that that if you take this sort of the space of all disjoint ordered pairs on a line, that's not contractible. There's like, you could either have them in this order or this order. And so that space is, well, if I fix one of them, there's a contractible choice for the first one. The other one has a zero sphere worth of choices. And if you look at sort of higher dimensions, you have a sphere worth of choices. And so E infinity is about when you have an infinite dimensional sphere. And then if you have decided to be bored with my talk, remind yourself the proof that the infinity sphere is contractible. That's it. You can write, what?
Just formalize in one. I looked in Wikipedia and it's for everything.
Okay, apparently the comment the comment for those people online is that E stands for everything. Good. Okay. Yeah. So my goal for my talk was to tell you about deeper algebra, which is different, which is also cool. So in deeper algebra, my goal, higher algebra was about taking sets and then adding the ability to talk about isomorphisms between elements in a set. And so it adds in higher algebra, you think of putting you kind of keep elements of a set at height zero when you add higher structures there. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put elements in my sets at height at depth zero, and I'm going to add structure that goes below. That's why it's called deeper. Okay, so here's the example. As I said, I'm only going to do commutative algebra. There is an interesting way to embed the world, the category of commutative rings into an interesting, larger, sort of richer world, which is the category of let's say, Kurbian additive symmetric bundle categories, excuse me. So this was the sort of K-theory example. I'm going to use this notation B hat for reasons that Marcus knows. So if I have a commutative ring, I can look at its category of finitely generated projective modules. I could look at other categories of modules, and for most of what I say, it won't matter what category of modules I use. This is the smallest good category of modules to work with. So you can look at the category of finitely generated projective modules, and this has a direct sum operation, just obviously, and it has a tensor product operation, almost as obviously. And so this category is of some version of a ring. So this is the K-theory example. This is the category of vector bundles, is really what I'm talking about. And so I want to think of it as a one categorical ring. I'm going to stop writing the word categorical. I'm going to call this a one ring. This is an example of a one ring. Now, it's not an interesting one ring. It was determined by a zero ring. but it is a one ring. And so from here on out, when I say a one ring or a one categorical ring, I'm just going to define that to include this example. So it's a symmetric monoidal additive and idempotent complete one category. And the point is that zero rings, ordinary rings, embed fully faithfully into one rings. But there's lots of other one rings than just the zero rings. For instance, there's the representations of a group. Nice standard example of a symmetric monoidal category. In fact, most of symmetric monoidal category theory, I think, originally was, a lot of work in tensor categories is really about the specific example of representations of a group. There was a question.
What is idempotent complete?
So idempotent means self-powered, so the same word is also called Kurubi complete, but Kurubi says that this is the most boring thing ever and it doesn't deserve his name on it. I don't know what can be seen or not. Well, yeah, but I mean, I was going to put this back down. I'll put this up for a moment, and then I don't even want to deal with another, so that has writing on it too. So this means the following. So an idempotent is some endomorphism of something which squares to itself as a projector, and a standard exercise. Right, so an example is that, another definition. Section retract is a pair of maps. Do I have favorite names for these? Not really. F and G. So that if you go up and back down, you get the identity. And it's easy to see that given a section retract, it immediately happens that if you go down and back up, this will square to itself. So there's an example of an idempotent. And the standard exercise in a sort of first course is that that if P factors as a section retract, then the factorization is unique. And so I'll say it's idempotent complete when every idempotent factors as a section retract. And
why?
Right.
This is zero rings or some generalization.
Well, this is just a very, very useful notion. Right. So why? So. I mean, the vibe reason is that I think of okay, but this is not a very good vibe reason. I already liked idempotent complete categories, and then I decided that I really wanted to think of this as something to do with subtraction. So what's really going on is this is quite classical stuff. What I wanted to do was to talk about categories enriched in abelian groups. And then in any setting, you can ask yourself, this is all standard stuff. It's 50 years old. It's the name associated with all of what I'm about to say is Laveyre. So if you talk about, say, categories enriched in abelian groups, you can ask yourself, so let me talk a moment more about this example to show this. So here's another exercise, which is that you could take the diagram, which has just X, you could take this diagram. That's some diagram in your. Suppose you have a category in that diagram. So you have an object, an endomorphism, which squares to itself in your category. That diagram might or might not have a limit. Because in general, a diagram might or might not have a limit. If it has a limit, then it's then it factors it as a section retract, and conversely, the section retract factorization is a limit. And it's also true for colimits. But on the other hand, being a section retract is equational. So this is an example of a limit which is preserved, which is sort of, if it exists for equational reasons. Yeah, the limit, not the limit, I want the limit of this, of the diagram. This is not a free diagram, I have one relation. I have an object, a morphism, and the relation that that morphism squares to itself. There's some diagram presented that way. And the point, it turns out that the limit of that diagram, if it exists, it exists for equational reasons. Most limits, the word limit, why would we call it a limit? It's because limits are an analytic notion. Most limits are not preserved by most functors. That's to say that most limits don't hold for, aren't there for equational reasons. They're there for sort of analytic reasons. Usually to be a limit, you have to test against every other object in your category. Whereas for this one, you can just test equationally, which means it holds for all functors. So a limit's called absolute when it has this flavor that it holds for all, that it's like true for equational reasons. And these are precisely those categories that have all equational limits, absolute limits. So there's the actual answer. But the sort of, if you want to be like, why does this feel like a ring? You might say like, this is some version of being able to subtract. It's like I can kind of subtract off the sort of image or the kernel of P. I'm not asking arbitrary like kernels to exist because I like, I don't know, finitely generated projective. I wanted this example, finitely generated projective modules. And you'd be like, well, why didn't you like free modules? And I'd be like, I don't know, these ones are better. they're better for algebraic geometry. Like, if you ask yourself, like, who are the vector bundles on a space, they're precisely the finitely generated free modules over the sheaf of rings. So the structure sheaf of the space. So this is a really good category to work with. It really feels like vector bundles. Free modules are like free vector bundles. And so that's really like, that's why I like this category. And then the abstract thing this category has is that it has, well, it has direct sums and it has images of idempotents. So, okay. But it was a good question. I mean,
thank you. Do you also need a tensor to distribute over the sums in this definition?
Yeah, I think when I say symmetric monoidal additive, I mean that it's one of these categories, and then it's a symmetric monoidal one of these. Yeah. And then, but anyway, it's as soon as the symmetric monoidal structure preserves, like, the fact that it's enriched, then it will distribute over direct sums. Again, because direct sums hold equationally as soon as you know that you're, as soon as you remember your enrichment. Okay. So that's what I'm going to call a one ring. And, but why stop there? So one rings, zero rings are basically affine schemes. One rings, like, give you access to examples of, like, give you access to groups, because, for example, I told you that there's an example of a one ring which is the representations of a group, and you can recover your group from its representations. This is called Tanakian reconstruction. And so one rings are a kind of way of talking about groupoids while still feeling like you're doing ring theory, still feeling like you're just studying the function. So I'm saying, like, if you have a groupoid and ask what are its ordinary functions, there's not very many, because a function would just have to be constant on components of the groupoid. But one of these kind of one-dimensional functions can see the whole groupoid structure. That's the content of Tanakian reconstruction, is the fact that a one-dimensional function can see the whole groupoid. And we said before that I really want to do infinity groupoids, so I need to probably higher dimensional functions as well. So a two-ring is, by definition, a symmetric monoidal additive and higher idempotent complete. I don't want to tell you what that means. Ask Marcus. His thesis is, like, exactly on this type of stuff. He's the local expert. So a two-ring is going to be a symmetric monoidal additive and higher idempotent complete two-category. And for the same reason, You can take a one ring and assign it its finitely generated projective. I don't want to tell you what those words mean. module categories, and that embeds one rings into two rings. Okay, now I tell you why this is called B hat for the experts. It's because B is the way you take a group and make it into a space, a groupoid with one object. And so B is the way you take a ring and make it into a category with one object. And the hat is the way you take a category with one object and make it into an additive idempotent complete category. That's what the notation is. And so an example for those people who've seen some mildly higher category theory is that if you do this to my favorite category of representations of a group, then you get the two-dimensional representations of a group. That's just the definition. But these unpack to the finite, semi-simple G-module categories. And there's no reason to stop there. You could just keep going. You could take like rings and embed them into one rings, embed them into two rings, and keep going. And this is what I'll call an infinity ring. And you should ignore the superscript PR unless you know what that means, in which case you shouldn't ignore it. But if you know what it means, you don't have to interrupt and ask me about it. And if you don't know what it means, just ignore it. And I wanted to say some other names for these. So Telemann calls these anti-categories. Lots of people call them categorical spectra. Scheinbauer in her thesis called them towers. I think Scheinbauer's thesis is the first place to actually read the definition of categorical spectrum. And if you don't know what a spectrum is, that's okay. I told you, okay, whatever. So let me tell you why they're called anti-categories, why they're sort of called deeper. So what I did was yes. We need the mic.
So when you said two category in the previous slide, is that a strict two category? Like,
oh, never. No.
Never, okay. Okay.
I don't know what a strict... the definition of a category... Okay. Probably...
Just because then you'll have the enriched Cauchy completion stuff. But
you go and talk to Marcus and he'll tell you what to do for the general stuff.
Okay.
My categories are always univalent. Every time I say category, I mean univalent category. And so my n categories are categories enriched in n minus one categories. But I can do enrichment in the infinity. Yeah, so you're asking a little bit of a sort of footnote question. So the footnote answer is that every time I say category, I really mean the correct version of category, which is that it's a bag of objects and an infinity groupoid of maps between them. But then I can talk about enriched categories. And in particular, I can talk about categories enriched in set, or categories enriched in abelian groups. And so when I say additive, I mean that at the top it's enriched in abelian groups. And I also mean that it has like direct sums and all the things it could have. So because it's enriched in abelian groups, that gives you the sort of, that means there's no higher structure. It's just an abelian group at the top. But then the category has sort of lower stuff below abelian groups. And so this is really how I want you to think about the way I want to think about an additive N category. Well, an additive N category lives in degrees, in some range of degrees. There's sort of objects, and then n higher than that is abelian groups. I want to decide to put the abelian groups in degree zero. And that's because the limit I took is always sort of sticking, like the things I had before, it keeps them at the top, and then it allows new structure below. If you ask what's interesting in representations of a group has like the identity representation. It has all these other representations. And the endomorphism of the identity is still somewhere. And then all the other representations live somewhere else. And then if I keep going, I kind of keep sticking stuff underneath it. So that's why I call these deeper. If they're going infinitely deep. That's why Telemann called them anti-categories. And there's a sort of richer world. So categorical spectra, that word means something that allows in all directions. So these are examples. These are categorical spectra enriched in abelian groups, is what I'm working with. So I said that. So you keep putting more and more stuff below. I have some comments in yellow that I'm going to skip. You can ask me later. So now let me use these for something. How am I doing on time? Oh, beautiful. Then I'm like roughly halfway through my slides. So Right. So I said I want to do ring theory. I want to do commutative algebra. And the very first thing you do with commutative algebra is you do Galois theory. Like, long before you invented a ring, you invented what a polynomial was. So let's do some Galois theory. So, right. So I'll just sort of write down the definition. I'm not going to tell you yet what a polynomial is. Why don't I tell you what a polynomial is? Because what is a polynomial? A polynomial is a ring. Like, if you have a field and you ask what's a polynomial over that field, that's a ring extension of your field with a single generator. And maybe it should be a finite degree ring extension with a single generator. That's the definition of polynomial. And of course, with a chosen generator. So that's the definition of polynomial. It's a singly generated finite degree ring extension. But most of the time when you're working with, like, when you're doing Galois theory, when you're doing studying polynomials, you don't care about the generator. That's the whole point of Galois theory, is you only care about that ring extension and not who its single generator is. And so you just never need to talk about polynomials ever. You just talk about ring extensions. And I don't know what a deeper polynomial is, but I do know what a ring extension is, because I know what a ring is. Okay. So if you have a group G, a G Galois extension is of some ring R, is a ring S together with a G action whose fixed points recovers the original ring. And now you're going to be like, that's crap. That cannot be the correct definition, because everybody knows that if you assume the axiom of choice and you look at the ring extension of Q into C, and you look at the group of automorphisms of C, well, if you have the axiom of choice, the fixed points of that group extension is just the rational numbers. Okay, I don't know. Maybe not everybody knows that. This is a neat, this is like, if you don't know the axiom of choice, then there's lots and lots of things called the, well, okay, if you don't know the axiom of choice, the complex numbers is by definition some like analytic object. If you don't know the axiom of choice, the only automorphism of the complex numbers is complex conjugation. And if you thought the only automorphism was complex conjugation, that's fine. You just didn't know about the axiom of choice. But if you do know the axiom of choice, there's so many automorphisms of the complex numbers that you can get the rational numbers as the only fixed points. And you don't want to count this as a Galois extension. And the reason you don't want to count it as a Galois extension is because it doesn't have any sort of the good things you want Galois extensions to have, like it doesn't have Galois descent. One of the sort of first amazing things about working with infinity rings, working with these deeper objects, is that everything about Galois descent is automatic. It's already packaged into the definition. Okay, that's the long-winded answer. In the yellow, I'm saying if you took a Galois theory course, you might have remembered this thing called the Hopf-Galois condition. You might not have known it was called the Hopf-Galois condition, but it was called the Hopf-Galois condition. And it's the statement that it's this extra axiom. You don't just ask that the fixed points of your action be your original field. You ask also that if you base change your field along itself, that's the same as functions on the group in some non-canonical, well, you can always, there's some canonical map between these, and you can ask that canonical map to be an isomorphism. The reason it's called Hopf-Galois is if you write down that axiom and compare it, I'm getting totally distracted, but it's really, really cool. We saw in Scott's talk all this stuff about like monads and comonads and wiring diagrams. So here's another, okay, again, if you want to ignore me and do a homework exercise, maybe you've done this before. If you have any algebra, I don't even have to write this. If you have something which you think might be a Hopf algebra, like it has a multiplication and a co-multiplication, and maybe they distribute over each other, so it's what's called a bi-algebra, then you can look at sort of the following thing. You can multiply, yeah, so you can look at this operation where you take one, so this is just the duplication. Scott, what was your notation for duplication? A dot. So you take one wire in that duplicates, and what's your notation for multiply? You had some funny symbol that was like a spade or something like that. Okay, so here's a multiplication and here's a duplication, and my time goes this way. This is called the optimistic convention in string diagrams. So you take a wire and you take another wire and you duplicate. That means co-multiply if you're a Hopf algebra, or it just means duplicate if you're a group. And then you multiply on the other side. And this is some operation you can do. And you can ask, is this operation invertible? And it's invertible if and only if you're a Hopf algebra. Or for a monoid, the invertibility of this detects being a group. Which is to say, it's a property for a monoid to be a group. You knew it was a property for a monoid to be a group. This is the fastest way to show it. You never need to package the existence of the inverse as a function. It's automatic. So, Okay, so anyway, so if you ask the invertibility of this, that's called the Hopf axiom. And you can write down a similar thing here that's like duplicates in the G variable or multiplies in the S variables. And there's some map that you can ask for it to be invertible. And that's called the Hopf-Galois condition. So anyway, that's like the deeper structure knows the Hopf-Galois condition is all I'm trying to say. And so then with David in our paper we haven't written yet, I'm just going to start listing things that I'm not going to claim they're obvious, they're just sort of true and why I want to proselytize this stuff. You can ask, how do you classify G-Galois extensions? Well, they're classified by just maps of infinity rings. And we can prove that there's a Galois group. So that if you know, et is short for Etzhal. The Etzhal type is just another name for the Galois group. And so infinity rings have a good Etzhal to homotopy type. They have a good Galois theory. So what am I telling you? I'm telling you it's just abstractly true. I don't think I know how to prove these yet. I know how to prove all of this when I'm in characteristic zero. Please, in your head, add the word under Q everywhere. I don't know if these are true in general, the way I've said it. I think I need to be in characteristic zero for this. Okay. So the type of thing we can prove is that existence of the Galois of the separable closure of an infinity ring. So that's the first theorem that we're doing. So, is this exciting? I don't know. I mean, you knew that there were separable. Yes.
So, does taking like et of R and R3, is that some kind of a junction? You have this.
Oh yeah, absolutely, okay. Absolutely. That's so. The second proposition. These are sort of different flavors. The second proposition is the more easy to read one. Here's some set. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm sure I need to be in characteristic zero for everything. I don't know in non-characteristic zero. Here's some set which does not depend it's not obvious that it's functorial in either variable. Mm-hmm. Like it's obviously coherent, it's sort of isofunctorial, but I'm in a world where I wouldn't be able to write down anything else. Mm-hmm. So here's some, okay, maybe by set I meant infinity groupoid. Mm-hmm. Here's some infinity groupoid that depends on G and R. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you that infinity groupoid is representable as a functor in the G variable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's also represented. I didn't actually tell you that et was a functor, but it is a functor. I just didn't tell it that it was a functor. But it's a non-trivial. I mean, it's a statement that et is a functor. That really, what there is, like under the hood here, there's, as you said, there's some adjunction between infinity groupoids and space, and between infinity rings and infinity groupoids called et.
I see. Okay.
And it's not quite that because Galois groups aren't actually groups. Galois groups are always profinite. They're not a profinite group's literally not a group. It's something else. It's has a different type. But what there is there's an injunction between infinity rings. There's a I don't know where to put the op. Okay. There's a contravariant adjunction on the right between infinity rings. I don't know what to call this. There's contravariant on the right. Mm-hmm. There's a contravariant adjunction on the right between infinity rings and profinite infinity groupoids. And this one of these directions is called et. And as I said, I don't actually know if that's true. What I do know, it's true if I'm in characteristic zero. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so let me be in characteristic zero.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So you are yawning because you already knew about. You're yawning because it's after lunch. You're also yawning because you already knew about separable closures. And so this is only interesting if I have new separable closures that you didn't already know about. So let's do an example. So everybody knows the real numbers is not has a non-trivial Galois extension. It's not separably closed. And you're like, yeah, I knew that when I was in like fifth grade. And so did Cardano. Like, it's kind of amazing. So Cardano was like in the 1500s. Negative numbers, you know, they're called negative because they make you sad. Like, negative numbers were not widely... people treated them the same way we might treat like complex numbers in the 20th century. It was like I'll use them as a mathematical tool, but I don't believe they exist, and they make me nervous. Like, they confuse me. That like, negative numbers are super confusing. Like, zero is a very natural number, in spite of the West not understanding this. But like, zero is the most natural number. It's the number of, like, you know, the zero is the number of zebras in this room. It's like the most natural number you can have. But there's no way to have negatively many zebras. Like, it's just not a thing. I mean, even in quantum field theory, like, there's no such thing as negatively many. Like, there's just antiparticles. So Cardano didn't really know, like, he was very uncomfortable with negative numbers, but he was like, look, I'm willing to use negative numbers as like a formal tool. And then I'm willing to use like square roots of negative numbers as a formal tool, because that's just the same as negative numbers. I just call them imaginary because I made them up, but like, but they're like no weirder or not weird than negative numbers. Anyway, so, I mean, people long before Cardano knew that R wasn't separably closed. He was the first person to really think about the ring extension that we now call the complex numbers. And a few hundred years later, depending on which reference you look at, you either do or don't believe this is a theorem of Gauss. You prove that the complex numbers has no further extensions. Well, it has no further extensions at zero rings. And that's where the state of the art sat until categories came along. So by the early 20th century, Fermi and Dirac and Grassmann had introduced a new category that we now call the supervector spaces. And their category is very, very similar to the complex numbers. You pick up the one ring of vector spaces. This is the thing I was calling B hat of C. Let's see. Okay, so you pick up B hat of C, so just the one ring version of C, of the complex numbers, and you add another, and you just do a degree two extension of it. You add a thing that you're going to call the odd line. That's just a name. It's an imaginary object. I mean, not imaginary in the complex number sense, just in the made-up sense. it's like, you know, it's a superhero. It's like, imagine, it's like a Marvel. That's what we should call these, the Marvel numbers. And then you decide, just by hand, that it should square to the unit in the complex numbers, and that it should have self-braiding minus one. And this construction, I mean, they didn't know the language, but it was basically due to Fermi and Dirac. And by around 2000, so Doplicher and Roberts did their work in the early 90s, and Delane in 2002, they proved a theorem that they didn't state it this way, but the theorem that they proved is the same as the statement that this new one ring is separably closed among one rings. There's no separable extensions among one rings. But this is really a non-trivial extension. It's a Galois extension. So I think, although like the content is Doplicher, Roberts, and Delane, it was probably my paper that first said it in this language. And then you can keep going. You can ask yourself, what about like two rings? And Hopkins had sort of speculated that maybe in dimension two, this was already separably closed. Maybe lots of people had speculated that, not just, I mean, I think Kapranov. And in a paper with Matthew Yu, we kind of fill that in. But in dimension three, so you might think the state of the art 15 years ago was maybe you thought that you didn't have to go beyond kind of this Grassmann-Dirac stuff. Kapranov thought you didn't have to. I'm not sure. I'm not telepathic, so I don't really know. But this year, Fried, Scheinbauer, and Telemann put out a beautiful paper explaining that what they really construct, it was sort of figured out maybe 10 years ago, that the three ring that you get if you just keep going is not separably closed, and they give a construction of the separable closure. I didn't tell you what it was. They really do give a construction of the separable closure. It's a somewhat sophisticated construction. We had known, David and I sort of knew their result a while ago, because they were, and that's sort of the motivation for what we've been doing. So anyway, so this is just to tell you that even if you start with the real numbers and you work in this fully deep world, the Galois group of the real numbers might be a very rich, in fact, is a very rich object. It's not just complex conjugation. And you're already seeing the early signs of this.
Why does the self-grading come from?
I just invented. You could ask yourself, like, what is a complex number? A complex number is a pair of real numbers with just an arbitrary multiplication law. The arbitrary multiplication law is there's like an obvious way to multiply. It's a Z2 graded number, right? A complex number is a Z2 graded number. There's a part in degree 0 and a part in degree 1. And if you had Z2 graded numbers and wanted to multiply them, there's an obvious thing you do. You add the gradings. And this is not the multiplication law in the complex numbers, but it almost is. And the multiplication law in the complex numbers is that you throw a minus 1 in somewhere. So I'm just going to do the same thing. I'm going to take Z2 graded vector spaces, so a vector space or a vector space times x. X is just a formal variable. And my rules are going to be that direct sums, whatever, if you want to tensor product these together, you just multiply them and add the gradings. But I need to make this a symmetric modal category. I told you that for any, and so that means that I have to decide, you know, now it's data for two things to be equal, because there can be a set worth of ways two things can be equal. And so the interesting data in the symmetric modal category is the possibly interesting way for x times x to be equal to x times x. And I'll just decide that possibly interesting way is going to be called minus 1. It has to be either 1 or minus 1, because if you braid and then braid again, well, I'm symmetric monoidal, so those can just pass through each other. So it has to be a number that squares to 1, but there's at least two numbers that square to 1, and I'm going to use the other one. And I'm just allowed to do that. Like, you can't... you have to prove that you're allowed to do that, but you are allowed to do that.
And actually, what happens if instead you use, instead of doing x times x, you just do x times x times x?
So what you need is the following. So I've decided x is going to be invertible. And so... So what do I really need? If I want to talk about a multiplication of an arbitrarily many things, well, I can distribute it out. The coefficients are vector spaces. I know how to multiply vector spaces. The only interesting thing is about multiplying arbitrarily many copies of x. So I need to decide what it means, like what x to the n means. And I need to decide this in a way that, well, there's the permutation group on n things that acts by permuting the n things. And I need to decide how this permutation group acts. And I decided that this is going to be invertible. And so it's this: the action has to be a character of the permutation group. And so the data of this action is the same as the data of a map from sigma n to the complex numbers. So I have to give you a group law homomorphism from the symmetric group to the complex numbers. And there's two of these. There's the trivial, and there's the sign representation. And I have to do this in a way that different n's play well with each other, and this forces it to be the sign representation. I mean, I have to do it where the different n's play well with each other, and this forces them to all be the same. Like, they're either all trivial or they're all the sign. But I'm allowed to make them all the sign. The fact that I'm allowed to make them all the sign is a slightly non-trivial fact. You have to prove it. What you really need is you need a monoid map, an abelian, just a monoid map. What do you really need? Yeah, whatever. I'm just going to leave it at this level of imprecision. I need to give you, for every n, I need to give you a one-dimensional representation of sigma n, and you need these representations to be compatible with each other. And it turns out the sign representation works.
But it needs to be one-dimensional, so...
That's right.
Because there's more than one-dimensional characters.
There are, but they're... Yeah. So by the way, for the people online, the question was why this one and not some other one? And the answer was that if you really start to work out what the rules to be a symmetric modal category is, you end up forcing Well, this one works. It's an allowed one. The theorem is that this is the most universal thing you can do. That's a non-trivial theorem. This theorem of Doppler, Roberts, and Dalin is not an easy theorem. Like, it's not a really hard theorem, but it's not an easy theorem. So, question?
In the case of the three ring, what is the degree of the extension there? Or
great question. So the question was, what is the degree of this extension? This is why I didn't tell you it. So if you take, it's still here on the board. If you take this three ring and you extend it to its separable closure, I'll just say the Fried Steinbauer Telemann three ring. So Fried Steinbauer and Telemann don't actually write down a separable extension. They write down something slightly bigger than a separable extension. I really want to just work with the maximal separable subextension of what they write down. The actual Fried Steinbauer Telemann three ring is an inseparable extension of degree. Has degree, I'm not going to put all the like B's in because I can't be bothered. I'll just, you know, so the correct, like it's in the correct, I mean degree in the sense of degree extension is a, yeah, maybe I should say the separable subring of is Galois for a group, let's see, now I'm forcing myself to do it. It's 2 degrees higher than this one. And the Galois group is infinitely many copies of the cyclic group of order 2 and infinitely many copies of the cyclic group of order 4. Sorry, that's just what it is. Okay, I mean, now I can't resist. If you do one more. So as I said, their ring actually is, their extension's not Galois. They also have some free stuff going on. So if you stick some extra B's on these, and then you look at the sort of separable four ring, the four separable closure, so you have this part for this extension, and then this extension, the next one from the three separable closure to the four separable closure is, there's sort of some degree, and then it's Q mod Z to the infinity Galois. But like, this shouldn't bother you. These are good profinite. No, that does bother you. That's not a profinite group. We need the dual group to that. You take the profinite integers as an abelian group under addition, and you take infinitely many of them, and that's the Galois group in this degree. These are not like these are theorems. Like this is not an obvious fact. This is a theorem. We've done the calculation. It gets easier after. Okay, I might or might not have time. What am I doing on time now? I think I used half my time on one slide. Is that right? What? I'm past my time.
You're reaching the limit.
Okay. Well, you will stand up. Okay. I didn't hear what you said. So, like, you said I had another 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
30 minutes.
Okay. Good. So you said I had another 30 minutes. Okay. So, let me tell you. Okay. So I was saying, like, this deeper stuff simplifies a lot of statements. Now, whether you like simple statements or not might be a bit of like, anyway, it simplifies a lot of statements. So let me tell you a little bit more Galois theory. And then as soon as you stand, I mean, I have to stop talking when you stand up, but as long as you're sitting, I can just keep going. So every ring, of course, has a multiplicative group, and in particular, the roots of unity, which is just by definition the torsion subgroup of the multiplicative group. And an easy fact, not that easy, okay, nice fact is that if you're an algebraically closed field, then your multiplicative group is Q mod Z, at least if you're in characteristic 0. If you're a prime characteristic, you just say like QP mod ZP or something like that. And Coomer, about 100 years ago, shows, 120 years ago, shows that conversely, if your roots of unity is Q mod Z, well, you're not necessarily algebraic closed, obviously, but at least you can access things about your algebraic closure. You can't access the inseparable part, sorry, the insolvable part of your Galois group, but you can access the solvable part of your Galois group. He gives a kind of cohomological classification of abelian extensions in this case. And you can do it as an exercise if you want. It's just about like diagonalizing matrices. So if you're a higher mathematician, as I said, a spectrum is just what higher mathematicians call an abelian group. And there's a version, instead of writing Z, you write S because you write S for everything. S has an action on every abelian group. In particular, there's a map from the homotopy groups of S to the homotopy group times the homotopy groups of your abelian group to pi zero. And what's called the dual to spheres, that's its name, is some particular spectrum where this pairing is perfect. The fact that there is such a spectrum is a theorem, not due to me. It's like a theorem of Brown and Kamenetz. The same statement that rings, that algebraic closure implies that you have specific roots of unity, still holds in this deeper world, and you just put an I somewhere. By the way, it's called I because it's the letter after H. And H stands for cohomology. So I repeated the proposition. Our theorem is the converse to this. So remember I told you Coomer's theorem. Coomer's theorem tells you that if you know your roots of unity, then at least you sort of can access your solvable, your abelian extensions by cohomology theory. Our theorem is much better than that. If I know my roots of unity, I can access my abelian extensions. There aren't any. It's kind of amazing. So it completely cleans up all of, like, Coomer's theory. It just becomes the content of this theorem is a Coomer theory. If you know what Coomer theory is, the content is Coomer theory. If you don't know what Coomer theory is, you're like, well, that's weird. There's no class field theory at all in my world. So this tells me some corollaries. It tells me that this is about abelian extensions. You could have also had non-solvable extensions, but if I can, those can only occur in degree one. See, every topological, whatever. I'm over time. I'm just sort of blabbing now. The reason I mention this is because a lot of the work that we're doing started out with some ideas of Mike Hopkins that got written up in his paper with Fried, where Hopkins was he didn't have the word infinity ring or categorical spectrum, but he had the concept. He had sort of intuited this idea that there should be some infinity ring of gap topological phases of matter. And he was like, I don't know much about this ring, but I have some like physics intuition that it should look like supervector spaces near the top, and it should have this lots of people had that intuition. Mike's intuition was that it should have this dual to spheres as its roots of unity. And he had some physics argument for that. And so our theorem is that the solvable closure, the separable closure of the real numbers is the unique thing satisfying this Mike's. Like, Mike didn't know if this existed or was unique. He was just like, I think it should be there. And we say it does. I'm sure I'm over time. Now I'm over time. So we have a cyclotomic character. And this is the point, is that, like I told you, the Galois group's actually really rich. We've calculated the Galois group. It's a really rich object. It has all sorts of ideas from PL surgery in the calculation. We can prove non-trivial theorems about phases of matter using this stuff. Like, I'm a physicist. This is what I care about. Like, we have a Liebscholz-Mattis type theorem that uses, like, really uses this technology to prove a Liebscholz-Mattis theorem. So, thank you.
Since we're already a bit over time, but we're going to the lunch. Yeah. We might have time for like two or three more questions. So are there any questions?
So if you do this, if we're not in CN with this vector and supervector and stuff like that, do you guys have any physical interpretation to what you would get? I mean, maybe not for an arbitrary category, but maybe some other thing that isn't just vect?
So I was hoping you were going to ask a different question. I was hoping you were going to ask, like, what do you get in other, starting with other fields?
Had you
asked that question, I would have told you that there's this Lefschetz principle that says that all characteristic zero fields are the same, and I needed to be characteristic zero. I didn't need anything else. But you asked a better question. You asked, like, what is the physical intuition? And my answer is that physics is fundamentally analytic. Physics is really about real and complex numbers. And it's not... Which is not to say that number theory doesn't matter in physics, but the physics itself is analytic. And this is like... I mean, a lot of math is analytic. Category theory is analytic. The real numbers are analytic, but they are the unique answer to some question. I would say that the moral of the cobordism hypothesis is that you are allowed to think of any nice enough category as some category of topological phases of physics. Like, you're allowed to draw string diagrams. You're allowed, I mean, most of this isn't theorem yet. It's just moral statement. And a lot of it's, I mean, but the sort of the tangle hypothesis, the cobordism hypothesis, is giving you permission to at least imagine that every category you have, like, you should think that you should think of every deeper ring, every infinity ring, as some, or you are allowed, I'm not, I mean, should is too strong a word, you are allowed to decide to think of the depth n objects in your deeper ring as n-dimensional phases of something. Mm-hmm. And you're allowed to visualize the morphisms as defects, as interfaces between those. This is a sort of, on the one hand, really useful like way to think about categories. And then, because it works, applies to every category, you can't get any real intuition. It's a sort of formal statement. So.
Thank you. Nice. Thanks.
Is there one more question from the audience?
So, one version of like higher gamma theory I know like small amount about is like the connection with like covering spaces,
yeah,
where you're kind of like classifying like locally constant like sheaves or something on like higher things. Does that perspective kind of show up at all in this like deeper gamma theory you're talking about?
Yeah. So that's. I would say that how do I want to respond to that? There are many The fact that we have such a clean definition is special. Most definitions of Galois extension and Galois covering and so on need some more sort of Hopf-Galois type things. But most of the time what you do when you're doing various flavors of Galois theory is you work really hard to figure out what a Galois extension is, and then you work really hard to give some sort of abstract statement that classifies them. And the best statement you could hope for is a statement like this that I sort of, where did I put it here? That says that your category of whatever things you have should, there's sort of two things you could ask for. You could ask for an adjunction of your category and some type of, so if you have an adjunction between your rings and some category, then in particular you can look at the corresponding, whatever they're called, monads or comonads or something of this adjunction, and you get sort of some relations between their categories of algebras. And on the one hand, what you'll get if you sort of start at rings, you might hope to get like rings under a specific ring. Or dually, that's just the same as spaces, like, say, schemes over a specific scheme. And on the other hand, you might hope to get, say, groupoids over a specific groupoid, which is just the same as sets as groupoids with an action by loops of the downstairs groupoid. And so this, okay, and that's the advantage of working in this infinity world is you don't have to talk, like, sets with an action is just the same as groupoids over a thing. So it does clean up a lot of statements. The fact that it clean, that's not new to us. That's sort of something a lot of experts know. So you can start, if, as soon as you have an injunction, you can start pulling off, you can start, anytime you have an injunction, you can start trying to like improve it to being an equivalence. And you can start saying, oh, well, if I have an injunction, then like the algebras for the two monads are more closer to each other than the original sides were. And you can sort of try to work out who are the algebras for these monads. And then eventually at the end of the day, you start saying words like, oh, on one side, to get an equivalence, I need, you know, to be working with finite Etal maps and not arbitrary maps. And each of these is a theorem. Like, you had to sort of prove which were the algebras for some monad. What was the image of some functor? But I think that's sort of where you're getting it. This type of generalization has been done in many, many closely related worlds over the years. Like, Grothendieck was already thinking about Galois theory of schemes. The higher mathematicians have done a lot. I should have mentioned their names. The sort of a lot of what we're doing is similar to, but parallel to, a lot of the work that the sort of Schlank and Yanovsky and others in that community have been doing with Galois theory for infinity rings. But they're somewhat, they're sort of, we sort of have what look like the same theorems, but they're, we're going down and they go up, so they're different theorems. Mm-hmm. But
thank you.
Okay, and I think that's it for the questions. Thank you again, Theo, for giving this amazing talk.